we can go ahead and kind of get started. There's information in there, but things don't necessarily follow the order of what's going to go on in here today. I'm Charlie Mullins, and I've been a CPA since 1977, practicing in the Oklahoma City area. And I have practiced with multiple ministries and parachurch groups and other nonprofits, as well as normal, regular businesses. Now, I probably should be next door because I need to learn courtesy and responsibility. And so if I take off in a little bit, you'll know it's my irresponsible behavior. And if you'll notice on the front of this, it's a testament to procrastination because I made an error in there and I didn't even have time to proofread it. So I waited till the last minute to put things together, to put the pamphlet together. So it has contact numbers there if anybody has questions that they don't get to today. Hopefully we'll try and get to everything today. And if you don't mind, I'd like Billy Hunter to open this in prayer for us. And
well, Father, we love you and thank you for this opportunity, Father, to learn today, Father God, from what Charlie's wisdom and understanding is, Father. We thank you for your anointing here today. Lord, open up our hearts so we can comprehend this and really grasp what he's teaching today, Father, because it's really important for us, Father. And again, Father, I just thank you for Charlie and for his willingness to come and speak and share with us today. I ask you to bless him, Father, in Jesus' name.
Amen. I'm not a speaker, and I'm sure many of y'all can speak better than I can, but we'll struggle through this part of it. I just want to say that I'm not here to have scare tactics of what you need to be doing in your ministry and things, but there are a lot of serious issues out there nowadays that the climate has changed that you operate in, and you need to work towards compliance. So I'm here mostly to inform you, not to try and scare you, although there's part of it that might seem like that. When I was a child in a land that many of us have forgotten, a long, long time ago, every day in church, in school, we said this prayer, and I'm sure that all of you know it. It's out of the New International Version, Matthew 6 and 9. And this then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. I'm going to take it a little out of context because I know that the term debt doesn't really mean debt, but in my example, it does really mean debt. God didn't plan for us to go out and charge our credit cards up to the maximum limit every day and then ask for forgiveness for all of that charging. So just a little word of advice on that. But we do serve a God who does provide our daily bread, and he can provide that our kingdom should come here on earth and that those things should be forgiven, or at least a plan devised to get rid of them. I have a lot of information. I may go through it relatively quickly. I don't know, but hopefully there will be time for questions, and I'll probably need those to stretch this thing out. God gave us a new normal about 2,000 years ago when his son came and died on the cross for us. And ever since that time, man has been trying to change what the new normal is. And we now have a political climate that has really done a job on the new normal. You people from years ago would not recognize the America that we have today. That the government seems to want in every aspect of our lives and our churches. And I'm not trying to equate this to the Hitler era, but, you know, when Hitler took his position, the Jews were the scapegoats for everything that was wrong in his country. And it happened over a short term or over a period of time. It didn't happen overnight. And now we're seeing a desensitization taking place in our own country. A lot of the things that you thought of as rights, you don't have rights anymore. In fact, they're telling you how to live your life. Things as simple as you have to have automobile insurance if you're going to drive on our streets. That's not a choice you get to make. You get to choose the company that insures you, but it's not a choice you get to make. We're fixing to be dictated that we'll have medical insurance, whether you want it or not, or whether you really can afford it. I mean, do any of y'all really know what affordable health care is? Because it's really expensive, no matter what the amount. It's got a healthy price tag to it. And, you know, you don't have the right to discriminate in who you hire. And in researching things for this class, I didn't realize that some of the denominations out there actually have information relating to how the gays on their staffs are to be treated, and they actually have more rights than most of you normal straight people do. And, you know, y'all are also facing situations where you have to be really careful in who comes before you that wants to be married. There are a lot of issues here that aren't just financial issues, but they are issues that can put you out of business, so to speak. You know, they even tell the schools, the public schools at least, what they can teach in school. They don't have any, you know, they have to teach alternative lifestyles. They have to teach evolution. They don't have any alternative to that. And you can't provide your own commentary relating to it unless a student asks you specifically what you think or believe. And even then, you need to be careful what you say. And last year, there were more nonprofits that had their tax exemptions revoked than in almost all the years since there have been tax-exempt entities. And a lot of that occurred because there were a lot of small nonprofits that hadn't been filing returns for years. And if they hadn't been filing returns for years, then they were eliminated. And that would not your churches, because they're not reporting entities, but it is primarily things like evangelistic associations and other small nonprofit groups that have humanitarian purposes that have not stayed in compliance over the years. Although some of the compliance issues have changed. And the answer to the problems that we have is education, about what we're going through and the involvement in the lawmaking processes. This has to be done in an appropriate manner. As you know, there's prohibitions against certain political activities from the pulpit. And I can't say I believe in that, but I can say that there are prohibitions there about what you can and can't do. And there were more religious organizations turned in last year after the election in relationship to their tax-exempt status and the ability that they may have to lose that tax-exempt status over what somebody that was in the audience determined might have been political activity. All of those complaints are turned in to the Internal Revenue Service, the U.S. Treasury Department, and they evaluate those. Currently, there's a small moratorium on church audits because the Internal Revenue Service is trying to decide what level employee has the right to order an audit on a church or a church-related group. And that's because here in the past, that's been designated to lower-level employees, and the courts have determined that the level of decision-making there is a whole lot less. It's not at a level that it should be. They're auditing way too many groups and organizations. They don't have the manpower for it, so you stay on hold for quite a period of time. And as you know, I can say that God is still in control, and as far as His treatment of these things, He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. His precepts will prevail no matter what the government's precepts may be. You still have to follow those rules and regulations. But it's kind of like the contribution deduction. What if they got rid of that? Would it have an impact on all of y'all? And the answer is it definitely would have an impact. You would find out who's really into tithing and offerings because that's what's commanded, or that's what we should obey, and who's not into the tithing and offerings, who's there for a tax deduction on their return. And so it definitely will have an impact on people, but like I said, God is still in control. And I've already kind of touched on it. For any of your financial planning issues and things, procrastination is the worst enemy that you can have, putting things off, not getting to them. And there's a myriad of good reasons why you may not be able to get to all of those things. But some of these things can ruin your organization. Some of them that seem to be relatively small in nature. One of the first things I would tell you is that you need knowledgeable advisors. All of y'all are good at what you do, but we can't be all things to everybody, including to ourselves. And that's the reason why there's people like me out there and a Jan Calvert out there and attorneys out there that do know these laws and things and can provide guidance. It's not that they have to be the person doing it, but you need somebody to bounce things off of when they come up in your questions relating to any number of things, contributions, minutes, what's going on in your church financial atmosphere, all of those areas, and any areas included. Church has been targeted by the Internal Revenue Service as a soft target, meaning they can invoke a lot of changes, issue a lot of penalties, and collect a lot of money out of church organizations. Part of the reason for that is because churches have been non-reporting entities. A lot of them haven't even bothered to keep a set of books and records. They don't have documentation to support what should have been in their books and records. And so when the Internal Revenue Service comes in, they find a lot of errors in the organization, and they have the right to not only come to the church and ask for money, they can also demand that the board of directors be liable, the board of trustees, whatever the governing body is within your entity, that they be liable for those tax liabilities, which also has an effect on their families, because if you individually end up having to pay a penalty for your church, because the liability is what's called joint and several. In other words, there's a liability issue of about $10,000 for excess benefits, which is Form 4950 or Section 4958 in the Internal Revenue Code. And it's the really hot area for the Internal Revenue Service at this point in time. If they determine that there have been excess benefits, whether the infraction is intentional or unintentional, doesn't matter. You know, it used to be there was an air of leniency about the Internal Revenue Service. They were actually there helping the tax-exempt organizations. That time period is past. They're not your friend, and they're not there to help you. They have fundraising criteria for the United States government as their primary goal, and they really don't care whose toes they have to step on to get there. And if you don't know what Section 4958 is, you might want to actually look at the provisions of Section 4958, because you can be violating those provisions without even knowing you're violating those provisions. And the good news is, if you voluntarily, before you enter into an audit, make the determination that things have not been done correctly in the past, you can correct those mistakes before you get into the position of being in an audit, and you'll not only be looked upon more favorably, you'll have minimized or eliminated the penalty positions within your organization. Obamacare is one of the new things in there. And does the church have to comply? Well, the church does not have to comply with Obamacare. But all of you, as individuals, do have to comply with Obamacare. And the government has taken the position that the HHS mandate, the Health and Human Services mandate, relating to abortions, the morning after pill, all of those type of things, they have taken the position that this is a Catholic issue, and it's primarily the Catholics that they've addressed, but it's also an evangelical issue. We have an instance here in the state of Oklahoma that's really a large instance, which is Hobby Lobby, and the fines that are being lobbied against them are enormous and would put most companies out of business. They happen to have the resources to at least be able to fight this. They are asking for an injunction against the penalties, that they not be levied during the period of time that they are fighting the issue. But the primary defense of the government in this is that they're not a Christian organization. The government's definition of a Christian organization is a church, not an individual company. And I'm telling you, there's members in your church that have Christian organizations and Christian businesses that this should apply to as well, as relating to the mandates, relating to the morning after pills, the abortions. And you may not think you're funding abortions, but if you go with the state insurance exchanges, there's a dollar per month of every premium that's paid for every individual that's employed that goes into a special fund, and that special fund is to fund abortions and to provide contraceptive devices. I'm not against contraception. I just don't like the morning after pill. It is a form of abortion if you look at what it does. But even though you think you may not be funding this, you will be funding part of it. And at this point in time, unless changes are made, there's not really a lot of options there. And that part of the bill was actually authored, and the advice was provided by Planned Parenthood to the congressmen and senators to include this portion in the bill. So it's just, it doesn't apply to you, but it does apply to you. It applies to you individually. There will come a time you'll have to provide medical insurance if you're not already providing it. I think it's a good thing that the church provide their pastor with medical insurance. It can be a combination of things. You can have a higher deductible for the medical insurance that's being provided and have a health savings account or one of the other flex spending accounts that allow you to provide funds to pay the amount up to the deductible for the pastor or the pastoral staff that you're providing medical insurance to. That will help them be in compliance with those laws as individuals. And it's, if you look at it from a reasonable standpoint, if you have to pay those premiums yourself, then you're probably going to need a higher salary to pay those premiums. Because like I said before, they're not inexpensive. As much as the government wants to say it's affordable health care, what they passed was an insurance act that's going to enrich every insurance company that provides medical insurance in the United States. And so it is one of the areas that the church can help you, because they can provide that medical insurance on a before-tax basis. And so even if you're not able to itemize deductions, you're not going to be having it counted as income in your salary base. Okay. Which leads us to the compensation package for pastors. And is it important to have a compensation package? And the answer to that is that it's really important to have a compensation package. Compensation is more than just your salary. It actually includes the areas of housing allowance, compensation and fringe benefits, business and professional expenses, and paying income and Social Security taxes. It's important to know that your housing allowance has to be approved prior to being paid. If it's not approved prior to being paid, they're not retroactive. You can't go back and cover a period that wasn't covered. They need to be covered in the minutes of your church, and they have to, they don't have a whole lot of criteria to apply, just an amount is basically all that you need, although there are a lot of forms that show you how to calculate an estimated housing allowance. But it has to be approved prior to being paid. It's prospective, not retroactive. If you know that you have a major change coming in your housing during the year, or don't know, if you have an air conditioning unit that goes out and somebody tells you it's going to be $10,000 to replace it, even though it may not be memorialized in writing, you want to go ahead and change your housing allowance for that year to include the larger expenditure that you're going to have in there. Now, remembering once again that housing allowance is the fair market rental value of your residence plus utilities. And that's a fair market rental value of a fully furnished house. And the only people that this wouldn't apply to would be somebody that's furnished a parsonage that's owned by the church. And so it's deemed primarily that the fair rental value is excluded from their salary. Parsonage allowances are not subject to income tax, but they are subject to self-employment tax. So if you haven't opted out of Social Security, which is a whole nother issue, then you're going to pay self-employment tax on that. And it's basically a 15% rate. I could tell you that it's that times 92.35% times 15.3%, but it kind of gets bogged down. It's for that advisor to know. There are a lot of accountants out there that are good tax preparers, but there's not very many of them that do know what you need to have in your returns. what really applies to people in the ministry. If you have excess parsonage allowance, it'll be included as compensation in your W-2, or if you're still being paid through a 1099, as a 1099. Compensation is the salary portion of your benefit package, and that's what we all want to work for. Fringe benefits is any cash, property, or service that a minister receives from the congregation in addition to salary. And these might include things like disability insurance, but that's only if it's properly structured, which goes back to who the beneficiary on that policy is. Educational reimbursement plans, entertainment expenses, flexible spending accounts, health insurance, health reimbursement arrangements, health savings accounts, group term life insurance up to $50,000, which I can only say that, you know, there's been instances that have occurred recently where a member of the ministry has passed away, and there weren't even burial expenses available to that person. So there's had to be special collections taken up to try and fund those type of things. And so it's only good planning. And of course it's better if you can start when you're younger, because those premiums are lower. Unfortunately, I'm beyond that age. But $50,000 won't cover all of your needs, but it will get you a start. And amounts above that, as you get older, almost become cost prohibitive. It's personal use of a congregation-provided automobile is a fringe benefit. And it all depends on how you've structured these type of things, whether they come into income or not. The third portion of this is business and professional expenses. Remember that if you designate part of what might be your compensation, or if the church allows you a certain amount to expend on these business and professional expenses, that anything purchased through there is actually the church's property. So if you're purchasing a computer or a laptop and you leave your position as pastor of that church, it is not your computer or laptop. It belongs to the church. So you may want to download those things or not put those things in that particular area, but it can include research materials, taking an evangelist out to eat, all of these kind of things, which may have deductibility in your return, but there are haircuts. There's limitations to what you can deduct there. So it's better that those expenses be paid out of the church under an accountable plan, and it has to be an accountable plan. An accountable plan has three primary criteria relating to it. It needs to be in writing. And the items are: the plan requires a business purpose for the expenses, i.e., does it further the ministry or the church or its activities? Substantiation of the expenses, which is, do you have the documentation to support the expense that you had? In some instances, just a line item on a credit card is enough, but if you want to be conservative, you probably should have a receipt. Any hotel bill, a line item on your credit card, is insufficient evidence of, or documentary evidence of what that bill is. You have to have the bill from the hotel. And the third part of it is, there has to be a plan to return any excess reimbursements. In other words, if you got an advance on this to come to this conference and you turned your expenses in, you have about 120 days after this conference to turn your expenses in for it to be an accountable plan. And after that, you have about 60 days to turn in any portion of the money that was advanced to you back to the church. And it's imperative that you do those things, because if it's determined not to be an accountable plan, guess whose tax liability is going to get hit? It's yours. It all becomes compensation to you. And the other portion of The pastoral compensation goes back to making provision for your taxes. You cannot have taxes withheld at the church level unless you voluntarily agree to it. And even in the withholding of those taxes, the church cannot withhold Social Security or Medicare from your check. You're under SECA, which is the Self-Employment Contribution Act, and you have to make provisions for those on your own. Now, it may be that you jack up your withholding to cover that liability, or it may be that you pay estimated taxes or a combination of both. At any rate, you don't want to get behind in these type of liability issues, because income tax collection is a serious event and has serious impacts on you, your family, and all of those that are around you. Documentation is the key in the reimbursable plan, but even if you have a non-reimbursable plan, it's key that you document any expense that you're reimbursing, whether it's to a church member or to a pastoral person, somebody on staff. They have to have documentation for what they've expended. It used to be in the past, automobile expenses. I could just say, you have a $500 a month automobile allowance and let it go. That can cover your payment, can cover your mileage, but that's not part of an accountable plan. If you're receiving an automobile allowance or some other allowance that you're not turning documentation in for, that's income to you. It belongs in your W-2, and you're going to pay taxes on it. And when you get to the point where you're itemizing your deductions and you get down there to the miscellaneous deductions, the portion of non-taxable income that you have, which would be primarily your parsonage allowance as it is represented to your total compensation, that percentage of any business expenses that you have cannot be deducted. They are limited. Schedule A is the worst place for you, or Schedule C in some people's place is the worst place for these expenses to occur. It's much better that they are incurred in the nonprofit organization level, so that you're not paying income taxes on money that was actually received for the benefit of the church and the church activities, whether it's purchasing research materials, or it's taking the evangelist out to eat, or paying for his hotel room. Those expenses are best left in the church, not in your personal compensation. Next thing I'm going to talk about is going to be gifts to the ministry and their staff. Are they taxable? And the answer's not as obvious as it might seem. I mean, we all like to think of gifts, and you know, I'm sure that most of your churches have had pastor appreciation days, Christmas gifts, a cruise for your 50th anniversary, whatever it may be. Those items, no matter what terminology you use, a love offering is not a love offering. I mean, it may be a benefit to you, but it is taxable income to you. Primarily, a gift given directly to the pastor or a staff member from a church member. In other words, I attend your church, I come up to you with the cash or a gift card or some item like a watch or something that I think you might like, and I give it to you for your birthday or for anything, that's a non-taxable gift. It didn't go through the church. It's from one individual to another. So it's a non-taxable gift. I don't get a deduction for the gift that I gave. My motivation was strictly to give you a gift. It was unsolicited. So that's kind of the criteria for a tax-free gift. Yes?
Is there a cap on that?
No, there is no cap on that. But I would say that if I got a substantial gift from somebody, because if you get into an audit that's what used to be called a TCMP audit, where they're looking at all your revenues and things and all your deposits, and you have this $10,000 sum sitting in there, and you say, oh, that was a gift, and they say, prove it. I don't know how you're going to prove that that was a gift if there's no gift letter or something from that individual that represents some kind of documentation that the gift occurred. It's also the problem with anonymous donations. You know, you can't really have an anonymous donation. Somebody needs to know where it came from. If a check is written from the ministry's general fund to the pastor or staff member on the behalf of the congregation, it's income to the recipient. So if the church says it's the pastor's birthday and we want to do this for them, and so they collect a lot of money and they turn around and they give you a gift that has a fair market value of $500, that $500 is compensation to you. It belongs in your W-2. If it went through the church, that's primarily the criteria. Now, the church can give to its staff gifts that are of a de minimis nature because the accounting for it is too cumbersome to really allow for the accounting for it. Those would be things like a Thanksgiving turkey, a Christmas ham, something of a minimal nature that's given to everybody on the staff. Those aren't included in income. They're just a gift, but it's because they're of a de minimis nature. Any cash or cash equivalent that the church gives you, whether it's a gift card or cash itself, is income to you. The rules to remember about gifts: any gift collection taken up by the church and distributed to the pastor may be taxable to the pastor, regardless of the deductibility of the contribution. When a gift is given to the pastor from the church's general collection and giving statements provided to the members for their contributions, the money or gift is always taxable income to the pastor. Whoop. I'm the only one that's allowed to have their cell phone go off. I actually have it up here as a watch because I didn't wear mine, and so they told me I had a time limit. The pastor or church could be held liable in an audit for incorrect reporting of taxable income. In other words, if you didn't report that gift as taxable income, as an individual, at a minimum, you're going to pay the taxes related to that gift in an audit if you didn't claim it on your return.
Charlotte,
yes?
I may ask, go back just a step. If, let's say we wanted to, let's throw this scenario out, that last week I preached on Judges 6, and I had a $250 gift card, and someone, first person to raise their hand and say, hey, what was the pastor's message on last week? And someone said, hey, Judges 6, I go give them a $250 gift card from the church's account. What's the procedure here?
Okay, that goes, there wouldn't be any reporting criteria on the church's part unless that gift might have been over $600, and then you could incur a situation. But you're talking about a gift to a member, not to a staff person or not to a pastoral staff. And as such, that's not going to represent taxable income to that individual. Typically, it's just considered a gift. Items of benevolence, unless that benevolence happens to be for a staff member, are not income to the recipients. But if it's to a staff member, a paid staff member, you may have a compensation issue, i.e., that benevolence might be deemed to have been a gift to them, and as a gift to them, no matter how much their need may have been, as a gift to them, that is a that's a, that represents a problem.
And only on a paid staff, like if it's a
yes, trustee. Only on a paid staff.
Okay, so we have a trustee member that's a senior citizen that's on has hardly any income, and we buy her groceries every once in a while because she really needs it. Is that
probably no problem at all.
And given in that someone, instance. If you heard through the grapevine, someone in your company, we don't have any paid staff in our church.
Right.
We hear someone that's suffering, you know, that needs a bills paid. Is it as long as it's under 600, or does it matter?
No, you can give them any amount of gift. In your previous example, you were talking about a gift card, which has different connotations because it's like money. Money, cash equivalents, all have potential liabilities related to them when you give them. But in smaller denominations, like the $250 gift to a member of your church, not to a staff person. If you gave it to a staff person, I can unequivocally say that you gave them $250 worth of compensation. They need to pay taxes on it. It needs to be in their W-2.
So if it was a Susie Q needed her house payment of $1,000,
right,
that would still fall under that, where she wouldn't have to report it's still a gift, or
right,
even if it's that large amount. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It would be better to pay the mortgage, though, wouldn't
it? It would be better to pay the mortgage, the individual item that they were needing assistance with, rather than give the money directly to them.
This way you have record of where, if you, the church got audited, you'd be able to show where.
Right.
Check went or whatever. Okay.
Right.
What about for medical expenses of a member? The church wants to get together some fundraisers and receive offerings and help a person with a particular medical problem.
It still wouldn't, as long as that person's not a staff person, you're not going to have a problem with it. I think you could probably even work around the issue in some emergency situations that the person is a staff person. But I think you better be real careful how you document it and what you actually do.
Well, this is just a member of the
but it just a member. You can pay whatever amount of their medical expenses. You don't have to send them a 1099. It's not income to them. It was a gift from the church to them to help provide for those medical expenses. Yes?
Play off Roger's question here. So he buys a $250 gift certificate. And so he had to go write a check, say, to get that gift certificate.
Right.
So now he's going to give it to somebody. Do you have to document? Because, I mean, who's to say he didn't give it to his wife or something?
Well, in reality, there ought to probably be some kind of documentation, you know, so-and-so won this gift, but I can tell you that it doesn't happen much in practice. But if you want to err on the side of conservatism, go ahead and document who you gave it to. And, I mean, because you are right, it's a cash equivalent, and I can go change it into cash tomorrow. And, you know, there's always ways to circumvent the rules for a short period of time. Somewhere, you're going to get caught. let's see. I think we covered most of those items. But basically, giving is simplified if the members give directly to the recipient. Let's say you have somebody that's going off into the missionary field and people just start coming by and dropping money off for that individual. Doesn't go through the church's general fund. We're not writing a check for it. He's just receiving the money from them. That's a gift. It's not an income item. They're not getting tax deductions for it. And generally speaking, if you can get the gifts to be given directly to the individuals and not going through the church, then it's better off for documentation purposes and better off for your tax-exempt status to go ahead and let that occur, as opposed to actually incurring a collection process and paying that money out, in which case it's almost always some form of compensation. especially if they're part of a ministerial staff or ministerial team. We'll talk for just a little bit about parsonages. One of the questions I get almost every year is, if I refinance my parsonage, do the payments on that refinancing qualify as parsonage allowance? The answer to that is, maybe. If the money is put back into the home, either in remodeling, adding to, purchasing appliances for, or somehow improving the residence, then it does qualify. The payments on it still qualify because it was utilized for an appropriate expenditure. But if the money, if you refinance it and you put the money over here in a mutual fund because your buddy's selling it and you're wanting to help him out and help yourself out, the payment on that loan is not a parsonage allowance expense. So when you refinance, there are areas that you'll want to examine as to whether they're taxable areas or non-taxable areas. And then the other question that I get frequently is, can I have one, more than one parsonage? And the government's response to that is, you can only have one parsonage at a time. And so what that was challenged by Phil Driscoll a couple of years ago in 2011, and he won the court case. But in appeals, that court case was lost because the tax code says the parsonage, a parsonage. It's not in plural, and so they did not allow it when it went to the Supreme Court, and that was kicked back out in 2012. So you have a single parsonage allowance that is available to you. Now, you can change homes if you own two or three homes and you can get more benefit from one of the other homes. Then utilize the other home. Like if I have a lake home, yes?
What if you have a regular ministry and you have a second home for ministry purposes?
Who owns the second home?
I do.
Okay. You can only take it on one principal dwelling place at a time.
But it wouldn't be counted as a...
Now, you can still take all of the deductions attendant to it on a Schedule A, the interest deduction, the tax deduction. If you rent it out, then the deductions relating to that can also be taken as rental expenses against any rental income that you have. It just would not be considered a parsonage. Okay? And question I get from a lot of pastors who are about to pay off their home is, so if I can't refinance without adding on to my home or remodeling, what do I do? How do I continue to have my, because the parsonage allowance is the single biggest, tax benefit that you actually do have. Well, you could, go out and buy a second residence. What qualifies as a second residence? A condominium, a timeshare, an RV, a boat. Any of these items, as long as they have sleeping quarters, cooking facilities, and a toilet, qualify as a parsonage. And can be, so if you get to that age and you want to buy a big cruiser and take me out on the lake, then go right ahead as long as it's got those items. Now, I do want to caution you. The lake cannot be the toilet. Can't do that. Yes.
The church can have
more than one, any number of them for qualified pastoral staff. They can have, you know, if you have an associate pastor and you have a youth pastor and you have a praise and worship leader and they're all licensed, commissioned, or ordained, then you can take a parsonage or give a parsonage allowance as part of their compensation. And if that compensation is a smaller number, like let's say you're paying an associate pastor only $6,000 a year, there isn't any reason that all of that can't be parsonage allowance. In which case it wouldn't be subject to income tax, but it would be subject to self-employment tax depending upon whether they've opted out of self-employment or not opted out of self-employment. We got just a couple of minutes left. Go ahead.
Charlie, one of the, on the housing, is there a benefit for not having a mortgage, or is it better to have a mortgage as your parsonage?
Well, I feel like it's a benefit to not have a mortgage anytime you can not have a mortgage. But it does limit the amount that you can take out as parsonage allowance. It doesn't affect the fair market rental value of the house or the parsonage, but the amount that you actually expend on the parsonage is going to be less if there is no mortgage.
So if it's paid for, then you could charge a rental fee on it? Is that what you're saying?
No. You don't want to charge a rental fee to the church, for sure. No, what I'm saying is if the mortgage is paid off, I mean, you have options. You can move to another parsonage. You can rent your old parsonage out. You can
buy a boat
with a toilet in it. but in buying that boat or that RV, you have to remember that it's the fair market rental value of the dwelling plus utilities, and you can't take utilities on one dwelling and the mortgage payment on another dwelling. It's all of the expenses attendant to that. One of the other criteria of a dwelling is you have to live in it at least 14 days out of the year. So if you buy that boat, you better plan on spending at least 14 days out of the year on it. You can send your family if you want, and that still qualifies. So I'm probably related to all of y'all that buy that boat. Another interesting criteria is, and this relates to anybody, if you have a house, you can rent that house for less than 15 days, and the rental income is not taxable. Now, where that comes into play is, and where I actually got to see it work really well for some people is, I had some clients that live off of Southern Hills Golf Course in Tulsa. And when they had, I believe it was the Masters Tournament or the U.S. Open, I can't remember which, at the golf course, there were people that were willing to pay $40,000 or $50,000 to stay there for a week. So they went and stayed in hotels and let people stay in their houses for $40,000 or $50,000 tax-free dollars. Just a word of thought. I want to thank everybody for allowing me to talk to you. And since we didn't get to a lot of questions and answers, my contact information is on the front of the handout. I take emails. I do get telephone calls occasionally, but mostly they're from my wife. And you can contact me. I don't have a problem with that. Just call me, ask a question. It may take me a few minutes to get back to you, but I can get back to any of you. At any rate, thank you for having me, and have a blessed day.